strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Qayran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say, we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when, I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Something that we can learn from Islam is how we conduct ourselves as far as employers, as far as directors of a company or an organization, as far as rulers. And what we can learn also from Islam is how we conduct ourselves as employees, as workers, as people who are a part of an organization. What kind of responsibility do you have in dealing with those who are under you, those who you are responsible for? You employ someone to do something, you ask them to do something. What kind of expectation is there from your side as the employer? What kind of expectation is there from the worker's side, from the employee's side? We know that working is something that is a part of our social system, and we can't do everything ourselves. You know, we need to ask someone to do some labor work for us, for example. What is the Islamic attitude to this? And how are you dealing with these kind of affairs? You know, something unfortunately that we can see in our Muslim community is we don't have that much trust towards employers, and we don't have that much confidence and trust towards employees. You do a job for somebody, they rip you off, they don't give you the money. You get someone to come and do a job for you, they don't do the job rightly, and then they take your money and they leave. And it works both ways, you know. Some people say, well, you can't trust these laborers, the workers, you know, because they're never going to do the job properly, and they get their money and then they run away. At the same time, you always hear the other side of the argument where they say, you can't trust these, the boss or the employer or someone who has contracted you to do something, because you're going to do the job for them and then they're not going to meet their end of the contract or the agreement, and they don't pay you. So it's working, unfortunately, it's happening both ways. How do we deal with this? You know, there are many beautiful ahadith that we can read from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that discuss this important topic. I think the one important approach that we need to remember is that you always need to keep in mind that when it does come to issues to do with money, there are two things that you always need to remember. Number one, stick to your words. Doesn't matter how the other person is dealing with it, you stick to what you say. You said this, you stick to it. Stick to your word. And there's nothing more important than that. And number two, always try to halil, to legitimize your money. You make sure that this money that I receive, I deserve it. It's my right. I'm eligible to take this money. If you take money and you don't do what you should, you don't meet your end of the bargain, then of course it's not going to be halal money, it's going to be haram money. You're going to eat that, you're going to buy clothes with that, you're going to buy food with that, you're going to feed your children with that money. Why would you want to give your children a luqma haram? And so I think these two important points need to always be in our minds. Number one, that I meet my side of the agreements, I stick to my word, I'm committed and loyal to it. And number two, that I legitimize, I halil, I make sure that what I am taking, I am eligible to have, I deserve it, it's my right, it's my halal for me to have.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
أطيب الكسب عمل الرجل بيده. That's why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says the purest, here طيب, here means the purest. The purest of work is that a man works himself, that you do the job yourself. That's the purest of work. We need to always remember that, you know, you're asking someone else to do something. Well, you know, you won't be able to do everything yourself. You know, someone, it might not be within your profession to do something. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that you need to always remember that you choose right people to do the right job. If you make a mistake in choosing an unfaithful person, a unqualified person, then of course, you know, you're going to have to face the consequences of such a wrong decision. He says, ثُمَّ أُنظُرْ فِي أُمُورِ عُمَّالِكَ فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا وَلَا تُوَلِّهِمْ مُحَابَاتًا. You know, don't have any kind of favoritism over who it is that you are choosing. If they don't have the qualifications, don't employ them. فَإِنَّهُمَا جِمَاعٌ مِّن شُعَبِ الْجَوْرِ وَالْخِيَانَةِ. If you don't have any kind of disciplining in the way you are choosing, then of course it's going to lead to not only oppression, but also betrayal. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, إِذَا أَسْتَأْجَرَ أَحَدُكُمْ أَجِيرًا فَلْيُعْلِمْهُ أَجْرًا. Now, if you are going to employ someone, from the get-go, from the very beginning, you agree, both of you agree on what is going to happen. I want you to do this, and you will be paid that. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi says, if you have employed someone, then you make sure you inform them of their payments. He also says, give the employee their wages before their sweat dries. So they've done their job, you're happy with the job, you pay them before their sweat dries. Don't give them a hard time and don't say, I'm sorry, I did tell you this, but I'll give it to you then, and then later on it's going to be a hassle, and you don't know what that person is going through as far as their daily means and requirements, financial means and requirements, and all these other problems and issues that unfortunately regularly occur in our community. Very, very sad. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
The limelight. The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week. And once again, U.S.-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Daniel Larrison, journalist. This article is published under the heading, The Saudi Coalition War on Yemen Claims More Victims. Stay tuned for more. The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week, and once again, U.S.-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. The death toll from a coalition airstrike on a detention facility filled with migrants in northern Yemen has risen to at least 87 people, and hundreds more were injured in the attack. Fragments of the weapon found in the wreckage were identified as coming from ammunition manufactured by Raytheon. A separate airstrike in Hodeidah knocked out Yemen's internet connectivity, which has cut Yemenis off from remittance payments and compromised the ability of humanitarian aid agencies to provide relief. At the same time, the coalition blockade has tightened and worsened the country's fuel crisis. As it has done since the war began almost 7 years ago, the Saudi coalition punishes the population of Yemen, and it still enjoys total impunity for its many crimes. The U.S. did not condemn the atrocity at the detention facility, nor did it criticize the Saudi coalition perpetrators for the massacre. All that the Biden administration could muster in response was to say that they are deeply concerned and that the escalation in fighting was of great concern. U.S. Secretary Blinken made a point of calling the earlier attack on Abu Dhabi deliberate without reaching the same conclusion about the much deadlier coalition airstrikes. This is unfortunately consistent with the Biden administration's overall handling of relations with the Saudi and Emirati regimes, which never face any consequences in Washington for crimes they have committed in Yemen or elsewhere. It is a measure of the absurdity and lopsided nature of the United States debate over Yemen that the only party to the conflict that is being considered for any U.S. punitive measures are the Ansarullah movement. The United Arab Emirates is demanding that the U.S. redesignate the popular Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization, and Biden has said he will consider doing so. It was the Biden administration that previously lifted the designation last year because they understood that the sanctions that came with a designation would be a death sentence for millions of Yemenis. But now there is pressure on Biden to endorse a policy of collective punishment against a population that is already experiencing mass starvation and famine. Yemen has already been suffering from the effects of coalition blockade, an economic war since 2015, and sanctions would be a new and heavy burden. The United States regime has been squarely on the side of the aggressors in this conflict, and it continues to shield them from the retaliation that their intervention has caused. As long as the United States supports and protects the Saudi and Emirati regimes, the harder it will be to end the war and the devastating humanitarian crisis that have already claimed more than 377,000 lives.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so it can be said that the blood running in the veins of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was the same blood as that of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Furthermore, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. From among the various beautiful qualities and characteristics of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that a few stand out. One of the qualities and characteristics of the persona of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam which really stands out is his clemency and his restraint of anger. Kazim, of course, which is the title given to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, Kazim means one who restrains their anger. And so we find that the biographers and the historians clearly have written and announced and proclaimed that clemency was among the great qualities and unique characteristics of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Historians have also unanimously agreed that Imam al-Kazim repelled the greatest of offenses with kindness, and that he repelled the greatest of guilts from the people with pardon, just as his holy grandfather, the great Prophet Muhammad, may Allah bless him and his household, had done as well. And so, not only is the blood that runs in the veins of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam the same as the blood that was in the veins of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but the manners, the behaviors, the sunnah, the personality of Imam Musa al-Kazim was just like the personality of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لما سئل عن أدنى المعرفة الإقرار بأنه لا إله غيره ولا شبه له ولا نظير وأنه قديم مثبت موجود غير فقيد وأنه ليس كمثله شيء.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, when he was asked about the lowest degree of inner knowledge, replied, "It is to affirm that there is no God but He, and that He has no likeness or match, and that He is eternal, positively proven to exist, present and not absent, and that there is nothing like Him." Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, in the interesting conversations that we have and these dialogues from Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, we find there is a very interesting conversation that happens between Imam Al-Kadhim and one of the grandsons of the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab. So one of the grandsons of Umar ibn al-Khattab, he end up wronging Imam al-Musa al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, and he cursed Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of Imam al-Kadhim's followers intended to kill this individual, Umar's grandson, but the Imam prevented him from doing so. Imam al-Kadhim decided to solve the problem in some other way. So he asked some people about where this individual lived, and they answered that he was a planter and a farmer on one of the outskirts of Medina. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam disguised himself, mounted his ride, and went away. He found this person on his farm and he went towards him and he said to Umar ibn Khattab's grandson, whose name was Al-Umari, and he found that Al-Umari all of a sudden started to scream and say, "Do not walk upon my plants." The Imam, of course, was not walking on the plants, but he continued, and when he reached Al-Umari, he said with complete good words and kindness and gentleness and leniency, he said, "How much have you paid to sow your land?" Umar ibn Khattab's grandson said, 100 dinars. Imam al-Kadhim said, "How much do you hope to acquire from it?" The man replied, "I do not know the unknown." And then Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam replied, "I only asked you about what you hope it would bring to you." And then the man replied, "I hope that it will bring me 200 dinars. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam gave the man 300 dinars and said to him, "This 300 dinars is for you and your plants as they are." Al-Umari all of a sudden changed and was ashamed of himself, especially when he found out that this was Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the same Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam whose grandfather he had been swearing and cursing at. And one day after this event occurred, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam went to the mosque of the Holy Prophet Masjid al-Nabi, and he found that Al-Umari was sitting there praising Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. The beauties of being kind, lenient, using good words, and being gentle with the people. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
In another occasion, Abu Hanifa comes to Imam al-Sadiq and complains to Imam al-Sadiq about whom? About his son Imam al-Kadhim. He says to him that your son, when I walked past him when he was performing his salah, he did not extend his hand. Surely one should extend the hand and not allow an individual to pass in front of a person who is praying before Allah, tabaraka wa ta'ala. Imam al-Sadiq says to his young son, "Answer him, ya bunay. Tell him, what is the answer that you have?" Imam Musa al-Kadhim says, "Oh my father, when I was performing my salah, I had dissolved myself and I was fully in attention and in awe of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's presence that I did not even feel that anyone went past me. I did not even go through any experience that a human being has indeed gone in front of me during my salah." And therefore, from a young age, Imam alayhi salam's exalted characteristics and attributes was there for people to see. Yet when it comes to the biography of the Imam and his life, many people would perform the ziyarah of the shrine of the Imam in Al-Kadhimiyya in Iraq. Yet when it comes to understanding his teachings, when it comes to understanding his statements, when it comes to learning about his position and his stance against oppression, his patience, his perseverance, his forgiveness, many people will struggle to tell you about the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. And that's why it's important for us to have a reflection upon the titles that the Imam alayhi salam was given.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
New accounts show that former President Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in plans developed by outside advisors to use national security agencies to seek evidence of fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Maggie Haberman, Michael Schmidt, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Had Role in Weighing Proposals to Seize Voting Machines. Six weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Donald Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states, three people familiar with the matter said. Rudy Giuliani did so, calling the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the voting machines. Donald Trump pressed Rudolph Giuliani to make that inquiry after rejecting a separate effort by his outside advisors to have the Pentagon take control of the machines. And the outreach to the Department of Homeland Security came not long after Donald Trump, in an Oval Office meeting with Attorney General William Barr, raised the possibility of whether the Justice Department could seize the voting machines, a previously undisclosed suggestion that William Barr immediately shot down. The new accounts show that Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines, as he grasped unsuccessfully for evidence of fraud that would help him reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the episodes. The existence of proposals to use at least three federal departments to assist Donald Trump's attempt to stay in power has been publicly known. The proposals involving the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security were codified by advisors in the form of draft executive orders. But the new accounts provide fresh insight into how the former president considered and to some degree pushed the plans, which would have taken the United States into uncharted territory by using federal authority to seize control of the voting systems run by states on baseless grounds of widespread voting fraud. The people familiar with the matter were briefed on the events by participants or had first-hand knowledge of them. The accounts about the voting machines emerged after a weekend when Donald Trump declared at a rally in Texas that he might pardon people charged in connection with the storming of the Capitol last 6th of January if he were re-elected. In a statement issued after the rally, Donald Trump also suggested that his vice president, Mike Pence, could have personally overturned the election by refusing to count delegates to the Electoral College who had vowed to cast their votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. The new information helps to flesh out how the draft executive orders to seize voting machines came into existence and points in particular to the key role played by a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron. According to people familiar with the accounts, Phil Waldron, shortly after the election, began telling associates that he had found irregularities in vote results that he felt were suggestive of fraud. He then came up with the idea of having a federal agency like the military or the Department of Homeland Security confiscate the voting machines to preserve evidence. Phil Waldron first proposed the notion of the Pentagon's involvement to Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, whom he says he served with in the Defense Intelligence Agency. The plans were among an array of options that were placed before Donald Trump in the tumultuous days and weeks that followed the election, developed by an ad hoc group of lawyers like Sidney Powell and other allies including Michael Flynn and Phil Waldron. The group often found itself at odds with Rudy Giuliani and his longtime associate Bernard Kerik, as well as with Donald Trump's White House counsel Pat Cipollone and his team. Around the same time that Donald Trump brought up the possibility of having the Justice Department seize the voting machines, for example, he also tried to persuade state lawmakers in contested states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to use local law enforcement agencies to take control of them. People familiar with the matter have confirmed. The state lawmakers refused to go along with the plan. The meeting with William Barr took place in mid to late November, when Donald Trump raised the idea of whether the Justice Department could be used to seize voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. Donald Trump told William Barr that his lawyers had told him that the department had the power to seize voting machines as evidence of fraud. Donald Trump mentioned a specific state that had used machines built by Dominion Voting Systems where his lawyers believed there had been fraud, although it is unclear which state Donald Trump was referring to. William Barr, who had been briefed extensively at that point by federal law enforcement officials about how the theories being pushed by Donald Trump's legal team about the Dominion voting machines were unfounded, told Trump that the Justice Department had no basis for seizing the voting machines because there was no probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. It was only after several early options were exhausted that Phil Waldron pitched the idea of using other parts of the federal government to seize the machines to both Rudolph Giuliani and members of the Trump legal team, and also to Michael Flynn and his own associates, including Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne, a wealthy business executive who funded many of the efforts to challenge the election. Phil Waldron, who owns a bar and distillery outside Austin, Texas, was previously best known for having circulated a 38-page PowerPoint presentation to lawmakers and White House aides that was filled with extreme plans to overturn the election. Rudolph Giuliani was vehemently opposed to the idea of the military taking part in the seizure of voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. The conflict between him and his legal team and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne came to a dramatic head on 18th of December 2020 during a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office at the White House. At that meeting, Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell presented Donald Trump with a copy of the draft executive order authorizing the military to oversee the seizure of machines. After reading it, Donald Trump summoned Rudolph Giuliani to the Oval Office, according to one person familiar with the matter. When Rudy Giuliani read the draft order, he told Donald Trump that the military could be used only if there was clear-cut evidence of foreign interference in the U.S. presidential election. Sidney Powell, who had spent the past month filing lawsuits claiming that China and other countries had hacked into voting machines, said she had such evidence, the person said. But Rudy Giuliani was adamant that the military should not be mobilized, the person said, and Donald Trump ultimately heeded his advice. Shortly after the Oval Office meeting, Phil Waldron amended the draft executive order, suggesting that if the U.S. Defense Department could not oversee the seizure of machines, then the Department of Homeland Security could, the person said. Around that time, Donald Trump asked Rudy Giuliani to call Kenneth Cusinelli, the acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, to ask about the viability of the proposal, according to two people familiar with the matter. Kenneth Cusinelli said that Homeland Security officials could not take part in the plan. All of this was playing out amid open acrimony among White House aides and outside advisors about how best and how far to proceed with efforts to pursue Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud in the election. That same month, during a meeting on another matter, Donald Trump asked Kenneth Cusinelli what he thought of appointing a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Mr. Cusinelli, according to two people briefed on the conversation, said it was not a good idea for a variety of reasons. When Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne arrived at the White House to discuss their plan to use the military to seize voting machines, they were not let into the Oval Office by a typical gatekeeper like Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff. Rather, they were escorted in by Garrett Ziegler, a young aide to another Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, according to Mr. Ziegler's account. I waved in General Flynn and Sidney Powell on the Friday night of the 18th, for which Mark Meadows' office revoked my guest privileges, Mr. Ziegler said on a podcast, adding that he had done so because he was frustrated with the current counsel that Donald Trump was getting. Even Rudy Giuliani, who had spent weeks peddling some of the most outrageous claims about election fraud, felt that the idea of bringing in the military was beyond the pale. After Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell left the Oval Office, according to a person familiar with the matter, Rudy Giuliani predicted that the plans they were proposing were going to get Donald Trump impeached.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. After the passing away of Imam Khomeini and after his anniversary, this decade of Fajr must show that for the people, the memory of the Imam is as precious as the person of the Imam. Well, if it is decided that the memory of the Imam, like all ordinary memories, will gradually weaken, one day it will disappear. Know this. The day when we in this country do not have the memory of Imam Khomeini, the country will suffer a great loss. You should not let this happen. The memory of Imam, more than ever, is in the decade of Fajr and on the 22nd of Bahman. Even more than the anniversary of the passing away of Imam Khomeini, this commemoration shows his noble personality. This is in fact the birth of the Imamate of this country, in the same sense that the Imam and Islam themselves have drawn for us. Before that, Imam was the leader of the struggle and movement, but from the day he entered the country and formed the Islamic State, he became the Imam of the Islamic Ummah. This is more important than the memory of death.
Millions of Iranians across the country have begun 10 days of celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that put an end to the monarchy of the Pahlavi regime in Iran. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on this regard.
The marches of our dear people on different occasions of the revolution, and most importantly on the 22nd of Bahman, are like a rain of mercy that acquaints eyes and hearts with the brilliant truth of the revolution, manifests the greatness of the revolution and the great Imam, and brings hope and happiness to friends, and it brings frustration to the enemies. And I thank God Almighty for this great success and grace, thankful, and the people of Iran for this effort, determination, and loyalty. The 22nd of Bahman, an anniversary that is not a dry, formal ceremony. Compare the anniversaries of the revolutions, the anniversaries of the national days in the countries, with this great movement of the people in our dear country. The anniversary of our revolution is not a dry and formal ceremony. It is a 100% popular ceremony. People take part in the severe cold and the scorching heat in all circumstances, where they need to be on the scene, and on the 22nd of Bahman, every year, the people of this field are honored and enter the field and show their presence to all enemies and opponents. This can be seen in the world. The 22nd of Bahman and the 22nd of Bahman March are a manifestation of national authority. It is a manifestation of the authority of the Iranian nation. It is a manifestation of the presence of the people and the national will and determination of the Iranian nation that men, women, old and young, take to the streets in all circumstances and present themselves in front of the eyes of the spectators throughout the country. This is very great.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. I want
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemen health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential health care services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthening our economic, trade, and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity